standing by, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's webinar. We have with us Mr. Nicholas Bornozis, President of Capital Link, organizer of the event. I must advise you that this webinar is being recorded today. We now pass the floor to Mr. Bornozis. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much, and good morning to everyone. Welcome to Capital Link's webinar series. I am Nicholas Bornozis, President of Capital Link, and today's webinar is on a very timely and critical topic for the industry. It is a roundtable discussion on the topic of where shipping is today, focusing on the buy-side investing and the sell-side research landscape. We're delighted to have with us four senior U.S. analysts from organizations with a major presence and footprint in shipping. Randy Givens, Vice President and Maritime Shipping Group Head, Equity Research, Senior Analyst from Jefferies. Amit Mehrotra, Director of U.S. Transportation and Shipping at Deutsche Bank. Ben Nolan, Managing Director at Stifel Financial Corp. And Chris Weatherby, Director, Air Freight, Surface and Shipping Research at Citi Research. We are delighted to have them with us. They represent a major brain power when it comes to shipping, and I look forward to a very insightful and lively discussion with them. This event is accessible through a live audio webcast and then will also be available as an audio archive through www.capitallinkwebinars.com. Please note that after the presentation, there will be a live Q&A session. Webinar participants can submit questions through the sidebar on the presentation page titled Submit a Question. When you are on the webinar page, you cannot miss it. It says ask a question and you can type your question there. Or you can email your questions to us at questions@capitallink.com. You can submit a question at any time during the event. And I will address your questions to the panelists when our discussion is over. The discussions and opinions expressed by the panelists are not intended as legal or investment advice or advice of any kind, as a matter of fact, and are provided for educational and informational purposes only, and Capital Link bears no responsibility for them. Furthermore, the panel discussion may contain forward-looking statements concerning future events. As we know, Capital Link has made a strategic commitment to the shipping and maritime industries. In addition to our annual conferences and weekly shipping newsletter, we hold industry webinars on a regular basis. To access our webinar library for past and upcoming webinars, please visit webinars.capitallink.com. And now I will start the discussion with our panelists. I will welcome them all. We are going to talk about four things today. We are going to talk about the status of the sell-side research. Then we will continue on the analyst interaction with the buy side. Then we will go to the third topic, the analyst interaction with the shipping companies, and we are going to conclude with the shipping market's outlook. So let's start with the first topic, the status of sell-side research. We have seen lately a trend of banks reducing their research coverage on shipping. But here we are with the four major shipping analysts online who have been covering the sector for a long time. Is there sufficient coverage of shipping today? Is there sufficient longevity and expertise in shipping research coverage? So I will start by addressing this question to Amit.
Okay, thanks, Nicholas. I really appreciate the opportunity, and thanks to Capital Link, and welcome everybody joining on the webcast. You know, I think you could argue that there's probably too much coverage in the shipping industry. I think, Nicholas, correct me if I'm wrong, but Capital Link has done some work, and they've shown that there's over 50 shipping analysts covering the stocks from a sell side perspective. That's a really high number relative to the market cap and the trading liquidity of the sector today. I hope it gets better. It certainly has gotten better with companies like Euronav, Ardmore, Scorpio Tankers now trading up closer to their net asset values, which is the first time it's happened, you know, in over half a decade. So I think that the sector is getting traction and moving in the right direction from an equity value and liquidity perspective. But I still believe, frankly, that the sector is still over-capacitized from a sell-side perspective in the context of the market caps and the trading liquidity?
Actually, thank you for mentioning that, Amit. Indeed, we have made a list of all the analysts who are covering the shipping sector today. So, and just on shipping, you're right, there were 52 minus 3 that, you know, have left. We have 49 right now, but that's just on shipping. If we include also shipping MLPs and Jones Act or the credit analysts on the high yield, that the number is even bigger. So I think you're right, there is ample capacity in terms of resource coverage of the sector today. But I would welcome the others to chip in and share their views.
Yeah, hey, Nicholas, it's Chris Weatherby. I would agree with what Amit has said. I mean, I think the reality is for a long time, the research market, I think, has been overcapacitized. And that's not just a shipping comment. I think if you look across sectors, and I know a few of us on this call cover multiple sectors, I think you probably would argue that that's the same, that the same dynamics are at play. There's likely a consolidation. This is likely the beginning of probably a longer-term consolidation wave as the economics just don't frankly support it. You know, we all get busy, you know, once every few years as the cycle turns and capital formation kind of picks up. But in the interim, there's not an enormous amount to do outside of, you know, there's just too much of us outside of those specific, you know, kind of times in the cycle. So I think we just need to be careful about kind of how it plays out. There's a lot of really smart guys who cover this sector. And so I think for the most part, investors are, you know, relatively well covered. I think the last thing you want is to have more sell-side analysts than there are buy-side analysts covering a sector.
I appreciate your latest news of analysts, you know, exiting the sector and so on. We don't want the impression to be out there that the sector is not well covered from a research standpoint, which is not the case. I don't know if Ben or Randy want to say anything before I move to the second question. Okay.
No, go ahead.
So I will address the second question to Randy. Randy, shipping markets have not been the strongest for some time now, and by extension, shipping stocks have not been the stellar performers. So how does this impact your role as a sell-side analyst dedicated to shipping?
Hey, howdy, Nicholas. Yeah, thanks again for putting this on. So, sure, there's certainly, you know, many clients who got burned in 2008 to 2011. Let's call it after the massive run-up from 2004 to 8. Then again, maybe 2014 to 15 in dry bulk, 2016 and 17 in tankers. So that's a hard memory to shake. You know, you see, you look at the 10-year charts, the 20-year charts, whatever time frame you want to look at, and a lot of them are down to the right. So very cyclical industry, so your investment time frame can only be 2 to 3 years at a time. You know, we're not telling many investors, oh, yeah, put this in your kids' 529 and look for it in 20 years, right? So it's certainly a shorter-term kind of cyclical trading sector, especially some of the more volatile sectors that are all spot exposed names, for example. But yeah, you know, in terms of sell side analysts, to quote Colin Powell, you know, you got to always focus on the front windshield, not the rear view mirror, right? So you got to look at what's going to happen in the next 2 years. And we can kind of go into that later when we look into all the different industries. But a lot of it is saying, you know, there's certainly been soft patches or just terrible patches in dry bulk or tankers or even LNG, pretty much every sector in the last decade or so. That said, there's also been 2-3 year time frames that there's been a lot of strength for either cyclical reasons or kind of event, especially event-driven reasons. So with that, that's kind of our role, is to really do well at the timing of when investors should get in and get out, almost as importantly, to our buy-side clients.
One of the comments I have heard from speaking to a number of analysts has been that we need to have analysts dedicated just to shipping. But given what is happening in the market right now and the investor interest, analysts tend to expand their footprint and cover other sectors in addition to shipping. How do you see that? So we're moving away from the analysts dedicated just on the sector and moving to an environment where the analysts will cover a wider area. How do you guys respond to that?
Yeah, hey, it's Chris again. I was just going to say, from my perspective, I think the economics of sell-side research are probably going to continue to demand broader coverage universes, which is unfortunate to some degree because there are going to be some parts of the coverage which maybe will get a little less attention. But I think for the most part, you know, that's just the reality of the world as, you know, commissions get smaller and we're seeing, you know, consolidation and fee compression from a buy-side perspective. It's going to be difficult for people to be, you know, as specialized as they are. At the very least, as you cover kind of the shipping market, you're going to have to make sure you're covering a wide swath of it in order to be able to service sort of the bigger group of clients. Doesn't mean that, you know, we're not going to be deep, because I think the reality is there's a lot of really good guys who cover multiple sectors, and I think that'll continue to be the case. But, you know, at least from our perspective, it feels like that's going to be the case, that we'll see that.
Yeah, I would add on to that, that I think you're seeing the same thing on the buy side. There are fewer and fewer very deep and narrow specialists on the buy side, and a lot more sort of investors who cover a broad swath of things. And so I think what you're seeing on the sell side is reflective of what's also happening on the buy side, because on the buy side they're losing share too to things like quants or passively managed strategies, and as a function of that, they just have to broaden out. And so I think it's happening in both places.
You're actually having,
and I think, hey, it's a mid here. If I could just chime in on just the comment about broadening coverage universe, like, I think, you know, that's one aspect, and the thing that makes the most sense is the LNG sector and really broadening out coverage to include energy minded investors. And, you know, Randy obviously is based in Houston, so he has kind of an advantage there, being closer to energy investors. But broadly speaking, like, you know, out of the 52 analysts minus three that you talked about, I mean, without trying to sound, trying to sound funny, but, like, only, like, 10 or 15 really matter going forward, in my opinion, because, you know, what MiFID, or Markets and Financial Instruments Directive, really does is separates the analysts that are perceived to be good, high-quality commercial, and places a premium on those analysts, and really kind of takes everybody else and weeds them out. And I think that's maybe the biggest benefit of MiFID. But I think, like, if you cover shipping, or if you cover shipping in LNG, or if you cover shipping in transportation, like, if you're a good analyst, you're always going to have an audience and a place to be. So, like, I just don't think, like, it's an imperative. I think at the end of the day, like, good analysts are always going to have homes, good commercial analysts, and that actually becomes a greater imperative in an environment of MiFID. The other thing that we haven't talked about that I think is important is, what is a bank's strategic interest in a sector, right? So at Deutsche Bank, I can talk about Deutsche Bank, but we have 6 billion euros of loans sitting on our books related to the shipping sector. The one sector that is mentioned at Deutsche Bank out of any sector on our quarterly earnings calls is the shipping sector. So Deutsche Bank shipping is a core sector for Deutsche Bank. And yes, it's cyclical. At some point, we'll be shrinking the loan book. Sometimes we'll be increasing it. And there'll be equity market capital or debt capital market opportunities, and there won't be. But I think that if you're assessing a bank's viability in a sector, you have to ask yourself, what is the strategic value of that sector to that bank? And that's going to really dictate a lot of, you know, that company's commitment to that sector from an equity research perspective. So that's kind of the other angle I would approach it at. Outside of just equity capital markets, there's also, you know, large debt capital markets and, you know, large debt funding in the shipping sector that I think is also important from a banking standpoint.
Thank you, Amit. And I think this opened the door to go into MiFID. I'd like to ask the following question. Another factor impacting research has been regulatory changes, and in particular, as we talked about, MiFID. So even though MiFID is a European directive, it seems it has been adopted widely by a number of U.S. houses as well. So how does this affect or change the role of the sell-side analysts and your interaction with the buy side? Let me address this to Ben.
Oh, sure. Thanks, Nicholas. So, Amit touched on this, and I think what he said was was true and poignant. I think the really MiFID is having sort of a two-pronged impact in terms of how research is being done and then who is doing the research or how we as sell-side analysts go about doing our jobs. And I think on the how part of it has gotten a little bit harder. To Amit's point, effectively now everybody in Europe and increasingly in the United States and Canada and elsewhere are logging and paying for specific activities rather than just compensating brokerage houses through commissions. And as a consequence of that, they're very mindful of how they're allocating resources, much more so than they had been in the past. And so they're less apt to take meetings just because or to meet with management teams they really don't care about or even to look at sectors that maybe are a little bit outside of their comfort zone. And as a consequence of that, so that's how it's changing. So it's harder for me. I assume it's harder for my counterparts to get meetings, to set up non-deal roadshows for company management teams. But along the lines of what Amit was saying, that also changes the who. So if you are a very well thought of analyst who has a very good reputation, then you're able to much more easily sort of get over that MiFID gap than somebody who is, you know, trying to break in or maybe doesn't have quite the same depth of reputation. Likewise, it's not just about the person, but it's also, I think, more importantly, about the firm. And increasingly, under these MiFID regulations, I think it's really, really hard for smaller brokerage houses without a global footprint, without really depth and breadth of their research coverage, to get on those lists of companies that are being compensated for their research. And they're certainly not being compensated through commissions anymore to the same extent that they were. And to the extent that MiFID continues to move into the United States, it's just getting harder and harder. And so I think not only do you have to be a good analyst, but you have to be on the right platform. And if that platform isn't global and doesn't have broad breadth, it's an uphill battle. And I think, as we were talking about earlier, MiFID is probably one of the culprits behind a thinning of the herd in terms of the sell-side research.
So we just talked about moving to a wider footprint in terms of research coverage on the one hand. And now with Ben's comments, it seems that the hurdle to overcome to remain in research coverage becomes higher, which doesn't spell particularly positively for sweeping research or research overall. Would anybody else like to add any comments to the MiFID impact? If you don't, then I will ask another question a different way. What does this mean for the public shipping companies, especially the smaller ones, which depend on sell-side research coverage and also on your involvement with investor access? Does that become more difficult?
Well, Nicholas, why? So this is funny because your shipping companies and CEOs are overly focused on coverage, right? I mean, there's not a week that goes by that a shipping CEO or ship owner will talk to me through the broader kind of lens of the market and then at the end of the day ask for coverage. You know, some of the companies, you know, throughout history that have created the most value, equity value, are ones that haven't even had investor relations departments. And so, like, companies should focus on how do they drive and create value for equity holders, and everything else will, it's like, if you love what you do, success will follow. If you run a good company and create value, generate returns well above your cost of capital, you know, investors will come. And it takes a track record. The problem is, to be fair, is in this industry, unfortunately, the ship owners have cared more about making themselves money and not shareholders. And that's got to change. Okay, and Mike Weber at Wells Fargo has done the industry a favor by the scorecard thing. I wish I came up with it first, frankly. But at the end of the day, You know, ship owners need to figure out how do we create sustainable value for all equity holders. And one way of doing that is stop having a promote structure where, you know, or a side company that creates money no matter what, that generates money no matter what. That is destructive to the long term. And every ship owner, you know, when I look at companies like Euronav and Ardmore and Eagle and who are doing the right stuff from a corporate governance standpoint, you know, when you have one person that goes against it, it paints the whole sector with a broad brushstroke. And instead of giving them, you know, Newsmaker of the Year awards, the industry should be talking about it as a penalizing the whole industry for one or two people's actions. And so I think that let's not focus on coverage or deals or whatever. Let's focus on how do we generate returns above your cost of capital sustainably. And if you do that long enough, people will come and be interested in the space.
I would just jump in here. Sorry, Ben. I'll turn it over to you in a second. I think what Amit said is absolutely right. I think from a smaller shipping company perspective, I think there's oftentimes too much focus on stock price and concern about coverage and that. And you know, the truth is you just got to put your head down, create value, drive earnings power, drive cash flow, you know, make acquisitions when it's smart to, potentially sell vessels, God forbid, when it's smart to. You know, just do what's in the best interest for the business over time. And the reality is the rest of the stuff falls in line. I know it's going to be difficult because it does, you know, the smaller you are, you wall yourself off from a group of investors who can't look at things below a certain market cap. But, you know, the reality is that's the business. When you went public, you understood that dynamic. You know, if that's something you know, challenged, the reality is it probably pays to stay private for a little bit longer to get to the point where there's some scale there. But, you know, the advice for shipping companies, put your head down, do what you're supposed to do, do what you get paid to do, you know, create some value, and over time, people will come here. You know, investors, frankly, sell-siders will look for interesting stories. Investors will look for interesting stories. They'll find the value. The market's pretty efficient in that respect. Sorry, Ben, I'll turn it over to you.
No. I agree. Although I will say, I think it's not quite as easy as it used to be for the reasons that we've talked about. There's not as many specialists as there used to be willing to kind of do a deep dive into a small company because they think that, you know, A, because they're already familiar with the space, and B, because they think there's a lot of value. The reality is the market's changing, and with MidFit, it is just a lot, for me at least, I find it's harder to garner attention for companies that have sub $1 billion worth of market cap, or certainly sub $500 million worth of market cap. And frankly, I mean, if you look at the holders list in some of those smaller companies, they're not your typical investors, and I think that's because your typical investors are just not interested in the smaller companies. Is not worth their time, generally speaking, or at least that's how they perceive it. And so I do think it lends itself. There is a higher capital cost for these smaller companies, and it is harder to access capital. And I think it does lend itself to within the public markets to bigger companies.
And then this is Randy here. I'll add one thing on in terms of involvement with investor access. It seems like, you know, when things are not good, a lot of manager teams go into hiding. Whereas when things start to see a little glimmer of hope, everyone comes out of the woodwork. Oh, yeah, look, it's great. So I think just being a little more proactive with non-deal roadshows, connecting with analysts, all these things throughout the cycle, right? Yes, hey, things are weak now because of this, and this. Or things are good now because of this, and this. But also pointing to risks kind of on both sides of the coin.
Well, that leads us into the next vertical for our discussion, your interaction with the buy side. By the way, I'd like to make a comment because it's very interesting, the discussion we had. Clearly, from a capital markets perspective, consolidation that leads to liquidity and bigger companies and so on is a definite plus. On the other hand, shipping, as we know, is a fragmented business, and in several of our conferences, we had the CEOs of larger and smaller companies stating that in the shipping markets, being small does not mean that you are not competitive. So we have a disparity between running a business as a small shipping company, which may be very efficient, value-creating, versus, of course, in the capital markets, having larger, more liquid companies. But at the end of the day, I think in the shipping space, a lot of the shipping companies listed are not exactly large cap for U.S. standards. So we do have an issue here how to promote the industry. But anyway, that leads me into the next topic, your interaction with the buy side. So how do you engage with the buy side now on shipping, and what are they interested in? What concerns or questions do they have? And maybe let me start with Randy. And, of course, I'd love to hear everybody's views on that.
Sure. You know, I think obviously staying in front of them with quarterly notes and kind of notes on different news-related items, press releases, but also on kind of thematic pieces, IMO 2020 or U.S. exports of LNG, crude, refined products, whatever it is, OPEC and what they're doing. So, you know, through notes, emails, phone calls, non-deal roadshows, analyst marketing trips, you know, there's various ways to get in front of you know, buy-side clients and kind of express your thoughts and your outlook and answer questions and being proactive in that regard. And in terms of what questions they have, a lot of them are interested in, you know, what is driving the space, what's driving day rates, what's driving asset values. So very interested in supply and demand fundamentals for each subsector. Definitely looking at balance sheets and leverage ratios, asking about, as Ahmed kind of alluded to earlier, management teams, corporate governance, you know, which companies have maybe conflicts of interest with shareholders, things of that nature, and then valuations, you know, be it on NAV basis or ideally in a more stronger rate environment, looking at EV/EBITDA or even PE at some point. So yes, I think that's kind of what they're looking for, kind of our thesis as well, but also highlighting, you know, certain risks. You know, what would happen if the trade war continues for the next 2 years? What would happen if a trade deal is signed between the U.S. and China next week? You know, and kind of what are the differences in that the market would look like in those two scenarios? So I think that's what they're looking for, and that's how we engage with them from our side.
Anyone else would like to chip in?
Well, hey, it's Amit here. So, none of my clients care about quarterly notes, to be quite honest. What we found to be really great traction for us is the topic of IMO 2020. So, you know, in June of last year, for example, we wrote a very large thematic report on IMO 2020 that just got an enormous amount of traction, thank God. And the next day we followed it up with a dinner where we had, you know, three representatives from the chartering and shipowning side, and we had 30 investors that showed up that had zero experience with shipping. And so, you know, the IMO 2020 implications have really been kind of over the last, more recently not so, but before that, isolated to the energy complex and energy investors, and people really understood the impact for refineries. And I would say over the last, you know, year, or really over the last 6 months, it's kind of broadened out for, you know, industrial companies, airlines, trucking, rail, intermodal, and then also obviously maritime shipping. And so I was in London last week marketing with investors, and two of my six meetings in the day were just dedicated on IMO 2020 and how to play it or how to invest in it and really focus on product tankers, maybe a little bit of dry bulk, though it's less defensible. But that would never happen, you know, 2-3 years ago. So I think this IMO 2020 has real legs with respect to getting market share. We've done non-deal roadshows with companies like Starbulk and Eagle, where we've actually had to add a day because demand has been higher. And, of course, in the Bali disaster happened, and the equity value for some dry bulk companies came out. So there's always these landmines that people are dodging. But we think on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the most engaged and 1 being not engaged at all, 2013, 2012, we were at an 8 or 9 from an engagement perspective when a lot of these companies raised money. You know, from 2016 all the way through end of 2018, I would say it was more like a 2. And now for us, it's really like a 3 to 4. So it's not anywhere, it's not above average, it's not average, but it's getting better. And our view is that if IMO 2020 plays out as we here think it will, you know, we've seen Scorpio Tankers, for example, go from 17 to 28, getting more traction from that regard. All these tanker companies trading at or close to NAV now for the first time. So we think that can continue, and we're pretty optimistic about what shipping equities. The irony of all this is all these changes on the coverage is happening at a time when shipping arguably is on the cusp of some nice secular, at least structural tailwinds with respect to IMO 2020. So we are, Nicholas, we are very optimistic about investor engagement, the trend of investor engagement over the next 12 to 18 months on the back of IMO 2020.
So you see the investor audience potentially expanding?
It is expanding. Yeah, that's a fact, okay? I'm having a lot more conversations about maritime shipping than I did a year and a half ago. Now, the only difference is I had zero conversations a year and a half ago. So I don't want to overblow it. I said on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being very engaged, we're at like a 3 to 4. So I think there's a lot more room to go, but we're definitely moving in the right direction, which I'm very encouraged by. And I think that will continue, if not accelerate, as we go towards the end of this year into 2020, when some of the dislocations between the fuel availability will actually come to fruition.
Thank you for the positive note, Amit.
Hey, Nicholas, it's Chris. I wanted to jump in there too. I think that's fair. I think the operative thing that Amit just said was the next 18 to 24 months of investor engagement. I think that's the hard part about this, but the one we just all have to get comfortable with is that this is going to be a group that people will come into and go out of. Again, it's a highly cyclical group, and so I don't disagree necessarily that there's going to be that degree of engagement, and it is increasing as people want to understand it. You're getting pulled out, guys getting pulled out of the energy markets to kind of look at this as an ancillary potential investment, as a way to kind of play this IMO dynamic that's coming up. But I think we all have to be kind of realistic that it's going to be, people are going to be visitors in the space as opposed to long-term tenants for the most part.
So as we see the investor interest intensifying and the investor audience expanding, do you see the is this more institutional investors? Are we seeing higher individual investor participation? How do you see the changing landscape or profile of the U.S. investor interest?
Ben, you want to do that?
Okay, I think I hit a point here. So you guys.
No, I'm happy to answer that. I mean, yeah. The bottom line is that I don't talk to retail or relatively small investors, right? One of the points of MiFID is that we're actually increasingly focusing on larger institutional investors, tier one, tier two investors. So like most of my conversations are actually with the largest institutional investors in the world. And some of the guys that are way smarter than me, but the smartest guys in the world about industrial companies. So I guess the comment about higher engagement is actually reflective of some of the largest institutional investors looking for other ways to invest it. Now the other thing, the way I think about this is that from an investor perspective, investors look at shipping stocks from a portfolio construction perspective. In the way they look at it, in my opinion, in our opinion, is they look at it as they're buying beta, they're buying volatility. And so many of these shipping equities are somewhat call options as part of a broader portfolio. And so at Scorpio Tankers trading at $26, it's really trading at $2.60, right, because of the 10-to-1 reverse stock split, whereas it was at $9, $10, right? So the opportunity for Scorpio Tankers, in my opinion, is $70, $80, $90 from the $26 it is today. And so I think institutional investors are willing to allocate relatively small, well, very, very small pieces of their portfolio to that type of upside opportunity. And I just think investors are very smart, Nicholas, about what the downside risk in shipping equities are, because every shipping presentation, every ship owner will tell you every $1,000 change in their TCE will drive $10, $20, $30 million of EBITDA, depending on the size of their fleet. But unfortunately, the other way is true as well, right? And I think ship owners don't really focus on that, to Randy's point, I believe, earlier. But I think all institutional investors are very, very, up on speed on that aspect of the operating leverage in the model. And in my opinion, and I've held this for the last 5 years, is that shipping CEOs, ship owners need to tell investors what happens when they're wrong, because every ship owner is positive, supply is going, you know, down, demand's going up. That's kind of the cliche in the industry. But what ship owners need to tell is their view on the market. Ardmore is going to have their analyst day today. I'm sure they're going to be positive on the market. But what Tony Gurney has done a great job of doing is saying, how has he managed the business from a risk management perspective? So if rates don't do what they think they're going to do, how are equity holders protected? And I think if companies are able to articulate that well, they just get a lot more traction.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I was on mute a second ago. I would agree with Amit that they're definitely the institutional appetite is better than it was, and it is probably, in my opinion, a lot IMO related, which is translating itself into tanker interest, some LNG related things. It is still generally, at least from what I'm seeing, is generally focused on names that are bigger and have more liquidity. So I'm not, you know, even if it's a tanker company, I'm not getting a lot of calls for companies that are sub, let's call it certainly 500 million. That, as it relates to the retail side of it, and I can certainly talk to that, I find the retail interest is transient. It follows to some extent what we see in the institutional side, but does tend to be a lot more yield focused, and so one of the issues there is that, as you have seen a number of the MLPs underperform and in many cases kind of blow up, it certainly is dampens some retail interest there, or at very least we want to be a little bit higher in the capital structure. It's around and it comes and goes, and tends to come and go the most when there's a lot of volatility in the up or down in the share prices.
So let me ask you, in terms of, if I hear you correctly, investors today are looking for value, for growth, for yield, given where the market
is? I don't think people invest in shipping from a growth perspective. They would be foolish to do that.
They're looking not to lose their money. They don't want
right.
to lose money.
This is cyclical high beta, right? You're trying to time the bottom and time the top, and it's less about, outside of maybe LNG, it's less about, call it the 10-year view or whatever.
And by the way, the irony of this whole conversation is that shipping companies create the most value during what they do in a downturn. If you look at Euronav, which arguably I would say is one of the best managed companies in all the industry, they created a ton of value back in 2013 by buying the Maersk VLCC fleet, then the Generate VLCCV during the last crude tanker downturn. And so like two-thirds of a company's cost structure, shipping company cost structure, is when they bought the asset. It's tied to when they bought the asset. So like what I you know, I think everyone's focused on rates and shipping. And my view is that, you know, the irony of shipping capital is that it's actually only available at the worst possible time. And when it should be available, it's never available. And so we advise our institutional clients, you know, it might not be worth much, but that's what we say is that you actually want to buy, you know, companies with good balance sheets in a downturn. And that's what's created value over time. So Euronav arguably has not created public equity market value since it went public in late 2014 at like a low double-digit equity per share. But it hasn't lost money. And it's grown, and it's prudently grown vis-a-vis its balance sheet. And so we think actually downturns can be very good friends for both ship owners and shipping companies and also equity holders that are willing to stick out, you know, for an upturn that will occur in a very fragmented industry. It always comes, you know, headwinds are always followed by tailwinds, and tailwinds are always followed by headwinds. And I think that you actually want to buy a shipping stock, you know, when that company has to do an equity offering. So, like, if you had bought Scorpio Tankers equity offering in October of 2018 at $18, you know, you'd be sitting on a significant gain and still have all the secular growth ahead of you. So we think, like, downturns can actually be the friends of companies. The problem is ship owners typically take all the capital they can get when it's available, and that usually typically is at the worst part of the cycle.
I agree with Amit, but even further than that, I think, and Robert Bugbee from Scorpio says the right number of ships to own at the top of the market is zero, right? And that is not usually the way that it plays out. And then similarly, the right number of shipping stocks to own at the top of the market is zero, because when it goes down, it goes down, and so it's not something that you can hold. Like Randy said earlier, it's not something that you can hold and own for 10 years. You hold it for a little while, and you sell it when you've made some money, and hopefully, occasionally, and you come back as a mid-set when there's blood in the street.
But you know, if you do that and you come back when there's blood in the street, then that's the time to buy. The company does an offering, and the offering is at that point of time below NAV because of the cycle, of the point of the cycle. Everybody's going to be unhappy that the company is making an offering below NAV without seeing how the capital will be used and how accretive it will be. So, anyway.
No, you're right, but I think that, again, it lends itself to having a strong balance sheet into a downturn, as Mitt said. Yeah, it's a time when people aren't getting good value for their equity, but if you have a strong balance sheet into a downturn, then you're able to utilize that balance sheet, and furthermore, you're probably going to have a little bit more equity value or ideally be trading at a little bit less of a discount to NAV than somebody who has a lot of financial risk. And so that is, you know, having scale and having a good balance sheet enables companies to leverage their position in the capital markets at the right times and not simply be relegated to raising capital at the wrong time.
Yeah, and what is NAV? What is NAV? NAV is not an objective number. It's a very subjective number. And the whole point of NAV is a completely flawed thought, because the implication is that you'll be able to sell your whole fleet at whatever value you think one ship is worth. And obviously that's not how things work in the real world. So NAV is completely like, you know, for lack of a better, I'm not even going to say what I really think of it. But generally speaking, you know, a discount to NAV today could be a premium to NAV 6 months from now, depending on the direction of NAV. And so I, and by the way, like, you know, Starbulk is an interesting case study, because they've done a lot of ship-for-share deals on a NAV-to-NAV basis that's independent of the public equity price of the company. So when you look at Starbulk today, you know, trading at a 30, 40% discount to NAV at $7.72, well, they just issued, you know, they just did a decent-sized ship-for-share deal at $140 million with the implicit price per share of $13.21. So there are ways, creative ways, where you can use your NAV outside of what the public equity market is pricing your stock at that actually creates value over time. But to Ben's point, it's really about the battle you have to forge on the balance sheet. Do you have the runway? Do you have the ability to sustain a weak market? And what's really interesting is that if you look at the shipping, you know, the shipping MO of management teams, is that they usually lever up at the bottom of the cycle and delever at the top of the cycle, to what Ben was saying earlier. What's really happened now is all these companies have delevered at the top of the cycle. So, well, not the top of the cycle, but as the cycle improves, they're deleveraging. And so if you look at your NAV, you know, at the bottom of the cycle, which was 2 years ago in crude tankers or whatever, they were at like sub 50% LTV, when arguably they should be bulking up. They grew their fleet in a very prudent way and in a capital structure agnostic way by keeping their LTV very low, even at the bottom of the cycle, when arguably they were incentivized to lever up at that point.
Well, Amit, you made a very interesting comment about NAV, and I have to say, from a personal standpoint, and I know we have talked about this with you several times, all of you, I personally do not understand the concept of NAV the way it is applied in shipping today. NAV relates to steel value. So the idea is you're looking at a company simply at the value of the steel. At the same time, that company may have invested in technology, in networks, in pools. In order to run efficiently a shipping company, particularly the large ones, they have made significant investment in human resources and infrastructure. And NAV does not.
Well, that's not true. That's not true. That's not true, Nicholas. Like, look at Scorpio Group. Scorpio Group has two employees as a public entity. All their employees sit at the private company, SSH. So when you go into Scorpio's office and there's like an army of 50 people, none of them work for the public entity. And by the way, on your view on NAV reflecting steel value, I would also push back on that a little bit if I could. It's because the gross asset value of a ship is basically the assumption of all the discounted cash flows that will come from that ship. So the value of a ship in any public equity kind of broker quote that you're going to get already implies in it some earnings power that ship is going to give you over time. And the reason NAV is the only, albeit horrible way of valuing companies, shipping companies, the reason it's the only way to value them because the cash flows are so unsustainable. So, you know, multiples of EBITDA, PE, I think someone mentioned earlier. I mean, those are completely garbage metrics, in my opinion, to value shipping companies because the cash flows are really good for like 2 seconds and then they're really bad for like 2 years. And we saw that in 2015 when crude tankers were at $100,000 a day in December of 2015, but the stocks went nowhere. It's because everyone was pricing in that earnings power as unsustainable, and that was actually the correct assumption given the crude tanker market, you know, declined in 16 and 17 pretty precipitously.
Yeah, I would say, and I agree, I don't think that NAV is a helpful predictive indicator. But I think, and this goes to sort of the psyche of ship owners, it is a relative value indicator. You can say, okay, in today's world, based on the number of ships and the size and age and whatever else, company X is, you know, less or more expensive than company Y. And I think that, and it bleeds through into investor thinking too, it dictates whether or not somebody should be doing things like raising capital, whether that's true or whether it's actually what should be the case. It is the case, and all of these guys have a number in their head of what they're worth, and they are looking at where other people are trading, and it's a commoditized, homogenous business. If one is being valued differently than the other, you don't ignore it.
Well, we have been discussing for about 50 minutes now, so I will skip through a few of the questions that I have prepared and try to go to the shipping market outlook. But one last question to ask in before we move to the shipping market outlook. The U.S. is a huge market in terms of the investor audience, both institutional and individual investors. And so far, shipping has captured a portion, but I would think a small portion of the overall investor universe. So what can be done to expand this universe, and how can you as analysts help in this direction? Maybe let me start with Randy on this one.
Sure. So, yeah, one more thing on NAV real quick. Obviously, I think the management teams also focus on that, because if you've seen the, 12 to 14 companies who have done share repurchases in the last 6 months, they've all been below NAV, right? And the ones who are offering are usually above NAV. So anyway, as for the market, you know, the first thing that needs to happen is the markets need to improve, right? So there's not a ton that management teams can do about that other than maybe help facilitate it via capacity discipline, you know, not just rushing to order new buildings, but also more transparency, improved corporate governance, as we discussed ad nauseum kind of earlier, consolidation. Will certainly help in terms of bringing in new investors or sizable investors, because sure, there might not be an operational advantage to having 40 more ships if you have a fleet of 40 already, but in terms of your market cap and access to the capital markets and financing and all these other things, there's certainly advantages to that. And then as for how analysts can help in that direction, obviously need to do our part in pointing to, as I said earlier, the supply-demand drivers of each market and kind of leading indicators of, all right, look for this to move first, and then this should move, you know, spot rates, which should move asset values, which should move stock prices, right? And then laying out a clear investment thesis and, importantly, time frame as well. And then on the other side, warning of the possible risks. Hey, this is what is likely to happen if U.S.-China trade war goes on for another 2 years, or if a new building rush comes in, or if you know, new, whatever it may be, new regulations from the IMO come in. So I think laying out those, you know, kind of opportunities, but also threats against them, is certainly a benefit that we can provide.
Anyone else would like to add to this before I move to the our last topic?
Well, you know, the buybacks, you know, Randy, you know, I love Randy, but the buybacks, you know, the stock prices today are all below where the companies bought back the stock. So they're unbelievably value destructive, in my opinion. And a shipping company should not be buying its stock back, bottom line. And the reason is because they spend so much blood, sweat, and tears getting the stocks in people's hands, the last thing they should do is effectively decapitalize the company, okay? And so, like, yeah, below NAV, I mean, the whole point that we just talked about is that NAV is a moving target. And so I would argue that, like, all these share repurchases were value destructive and also increased the risk profile of the companies. Now, not meaningfully, but technically they did. And the other thing is my job is not a cheerleader for the industry, right? I mean, like, I work for my institutional clients. They're the number one people that I think of, and they rely on independent research. And I think it's important if analysts are always positive and always bullish and always congratulating the management teams for whatever they're congratulating for, they lose credibility when they actually do turn positive, really positive. And so what we have done is what we try to do every day is stay independent, call, you know, have sell ratings when we think is a sell rating. I mean, ironically, the biggest, you know, we are one of the biggest bulls on Starbulk, but, you know, we were also one of the first people to put a sell rating on Starbulk, you know, in 2016 or 2014, I'm sorry. And so I think that that is important to maintain the independence of research. Ship owners should not, you know, bully analysts when they have negative views on the sector, because I think over the long term, that is what's going to drive the overall health of the sector. And you know, again, we are not cheerleaders for the industry. We have to call it as we see it from a fundamental standpoint.
Well, Ahmed, I was just look, DHT, Sting, Euronav, all repurchase shares below the current share price. But go ahead, Ben.
Well, I'd add in, I think I agree certainly with Mitt's point about us needing to be not cheerleaders. The other thing that I would say, though, it, just in terms of what companies can do to garner more investor attention, I am certainly a proponent of consolidation and fewer, bigger companies with bigger market caps, better capital discipline, and ultimately, at the end of the day, I think there are at least probably half of the public companies who, and generally people know, those companies will never be for sale at any price. They are tacitly private companies that are, you know, just happen to have a public float. That's not helpful. Those, you know, I think the maturation and the growing up process of this industry is still in progress, and I think if you're going to be a public company, your primary responsibility is to the public shareholders, not the family enterprise or your legacy. So that I think would certainly help legitimize the industry and investors' opinion.
But I think occasionally having, you know, a strong family behind the company or a strong shareholder can be a plus. I mean, you know, and I think a lot of the investment house shipping has developed, has been a fragmented industry, highly individualistic, and I think if you have the right people backing the company, it can be a plus. Anyway, if I may go now to the last, but certainly not the least of our topics today, if I can have you, each one of you, give us your, you know, your views on what you expect the market. I mean, my understanding from our discussion is that, you know, you have been quite positive that we are closer to a new inflection point. At the same time, we see major disruption with IMO 2020. So if I can have each one of you give me what you think about the markets, and from what I have seen, from what you sent me, it seems that product tankers and crude tankers seem to be on the top of the, on average, of your list in terms of turnaround. But I will let each one of you speak individually. We haven't heard from Chris, so maybe I can start this with Chris.
Sure. Thanks, Nicholas. I appreciate it. I think, you know, we don't necessarily differ all that much there. I do think the tanker markets probably have the best potential opportunity here. We like incremental trade driven by IMO 2020. We like sort of the supply-demand outlook as we move forward over the course of the next, you know, call it several quarters or so. And I think also we want to avoid areas where you see more potential risk from, trade tensions and disruptions that are going on that you might see roll through, you know, dry bulk and containers. So those are areas that we're a little bit more concerned about, a little bit more bullish on the tanker side, and, you know, to a degree on LNG, there are certain names within the group that we kind of like, particularly ones that can get you some yield, like a GasLog Partners, with some growth behind it as they see a pretty decent book of business kind of develop. So that's the way that we're thinking about it. I have a hard stop at 11, so I'll leave it there to pass it on to the next guys. Thanks.
So Randy or Amit and Ben, yeah, if you would like to.
Yeah, you know, I think on the, in terms of bullish view on rates, certainly tankers, with IMO 2020, with the refinery throughput capacity growing, I don't know, a million barrels a day per month from April to August, OPEC coming back eventually. Is it June? Is it August? I don't know. Is it November? So looking at the slowdown in new build deliveries, all these things. So the supply-demand fundamentals are probably most attractive in both products, tankers, as well as crude tankers. But if you look at in terms of equities, LNG and dry bulk are pricing in, you know, rates to stay depressed for 2 years, right? That does unlikely to happen. So in terms of the equities, I think there's some attractiveness around the LNG and dry bulk names as well. But in terms of just the market and rates, it'd be hard-pressed to find a better timing or a better sector than tankers at this point.
Yeah, and it's a mid here. So we like product tankers partly because there's a big total addressable market. Like the work we've done shows that there's a lot of high sulfur residual fuel oil that's going to be blended down, and that's going to necessitate just a lot more clean products that have to move around the world, and that's a big demand stimulus for the product tanker industry. We also actually like the dry bulk industry, not necessarily because of a demand catalyst, but really on the supply side. We think that, you know, speeds have to come down as a result to balance the charter rate with the fuel costs, and that will provide as a synthetic reduction in capacity that will drive, you know, improvement in freight rates. And so I would say that those are the two areas that we're focused on. And then, of course, Chris Snyder, who's my partner on the shipping side, is a lead analyst on the LNG names, and he's done a lot of good work on LNG, and Golar LNG is really kind of a big secular story that we've been focusing on here internally at Deutsche Bank.
Yeah, I the only thing I'd add to that is an area that we like that wasn't mentioned is the LPG side. A little small, niche-y, but I think there's a lot of, specifically in the United States, there's a lot of infrastructure that's set to come online over the course of the next 12 months that should create a nice demand tailwind.
Well, I'd like to thank you all. We've been discussing for an hour. It's been, longer, but I think it was absolutely worth it. I'd like to thank you very much for being with us today. Great discussion. I think the topic was particularly timely and interesting. And overall, I'd like to thank you for what you're doing for the industry and for the close cooperation we have. And I look forward to talking to you very soon. And again, thank you very much. And
great.
Just to let everybody know, this will be available as a replay. You can come and listen to this as an audio archive anytime you want. Thank you.
Thanks, Nicholas. Appreciate it.
Thank
bye,
you,
Ben.
Nicholas.
Bye, Randy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
See ya.
That does conclude this webinar for today. Thank you all for participating. You may all disconnect.